Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. And with me via Skype today is Dr. Daryl West, who's the Vice President and Director of Governance Studies for the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., but he's also the founding director for their Center for Technology Innovation. Thanks for stopping by, Daryl.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be with you.
So, Daryl, real quickly, let's talk a little bit about the Brookings Institute, since we have a little bit more time on our hands. Tell me exactly what that is. That's a think tank. Is that what that is?
It is a think tank, which basically means it's a research organization. We have over 100 different scholars who focus on different aspects of U.S. domestic policy, foreign policy, economic development, and metropolitan areas around the country. So we look at many different aspects of public policy, try and find out where the problems are and what are the possible solutions.
Do you take particular stands and then weigh in on them with white papers, or how do you take care of that sort of thing?
Individual scholars write research papers and look at contemporary policy problems and propose various types of solutions. So the institution as a whole does not take a stance, but the individual scholars do. They write papers, appear on podcasts, in web interviews, and try and promote their works through a variety of different means.
Okay, great. Now, the founding director for Center for Technology Innovation, that's why I'm interested. How did you get into that? Do you have a long background, a long history in technology and its development?
I've been studying technology policy for the last 20 years, and I got into it around the year 2000 when I noticed that governments were starting to develop websites, they were putting reports online, and then eventually they started to offer various types of electronic services. And so I thought that was an interesting development, was curious what the impact of that would be. So our first study ranked federal agency websites as well as state government websites on a variety of different features. We put out a report on that, and there turned out to be tremendous interest. And so that convinced me there was a real audience for technology at work, and we've been continuing that for the last two decades.
Of course, the show that I do is interested in STEM. I'm a physicist, but I'm interested in anything where STEM intersects society. And certainly the thing that I'm going to lead with, which is Elon Musk's comment that advanced artificial intelligence could start World War III, of course, speaks to something that I'm interested in very much. So I'm not talking about artificial intelligence specifically, but I want to talk to you a little bit about robotics, because I know robotics and, let's say, technology change, innovation, and I know you know a lot about that. So lead us through the past since the Industrial Revolution of how technology and modification of labor-saving devices has really sort of changed everything.
We certainly have seen tremendous changes over the last two centuries. In the 1800s, certainly the introduction of the railroad kind of integrated the country and allowed the United States to move westward and businesses to ship their products all around the world. We also then saw the emergence of the telegraph, which was the mass communications innovation of its era. And then as we move into the 1900s, we had the rise of cars and assembly line production and in factories that would mass produce these vehicles, and that certainly was very transformative. And then today we have moved into the digital world, and for the last 30 years we've gone from desktops to laptops to tablets and now smartphones. So the computers have gotten much faster, much greater storage capability, and much more sophisticated in the types of tasks that they can do.
So a fairly solid economic argument has been made over a number of years that when innovation comes, ultimately it's disruptive, but it will work itself out to the benefit. And so in this particular case, if you look at the past, can you talk about how that's been true up until now and whether there's anything that we have holding out for the future that could change that somehow?
I think most of these past technologies have been very beneficial. They certainly have improved productivity. There are lots of labor-saving tools that have come along the way. Some of them were controversial, like even when the car was introduced, people worried about the horse and buggies and, you know, what would happen to those individuals. But with most of those technologies, eventually people came to see that they were a positive good for society and they were beneficial for the economy. So today we're now seeing the shift to a digital economy, and we're seeing the development of robots, and factories now are featuring a lot of robots. There's artificial intelligence that's being applied to transportation, finance, and resource management. So there are lots of major things that are coming together today, and many of them do have positive economic benefits. But the one concern that a lot of people have is whether there are going to be sufficient jobs for the future. Because the one aspect of many of the large technology companies today is these companies are very valuable. They have valuations in the hundreds of billions of dollars, but many of them simply do not employ very many workers. Facebook, for example, only has about 19,000 workers. And so when you compare that to, say, General Motors and AT&T in the 1960s, I mean, both those companies were the two largest companies of that particular era. They each had about 600,000 employees. So they were large companies that employed a lot of workers. Today, we have large companies, and they don't need very many workers. And so people are just wondering, what is that going to mean for the future? That there certainly are many positive aspects of all of these technology innovations, but the impact on the workforce and the labor force is the question that a lot of people have.
Sure. So let's talk about a couple of pieces of that. One is the pace. So in the past, people responded, somehow society responded, and they were able to somehow, retrain, or people moved from the farms to the cities, or they did whatever it was they had to do. But the pace is certainly picked up now. So talk about the pace, and is that change in pace making it more difficult for society to respond in a way that's going to allow a smooth transition into the future?
The pace certainly is accelerating, and if you kind of look in the coming decades, the acceleration is going to move even faster. Shortly, we will be moving into the era of self-driving cars. In the finance world, we see automated trading systems. I think half of the stock market trades today are done automatically, meaning without human intervention. So in a variety of different areas, we're seeing robots, artificial intelligence, and automated systems come into being. And so the question that people are asking is just, are people going to be able to adapt given the fast pace of those changes? And as you mentioned, the primary challenge is really going to be training, because many of the new jobs that are going to be created are going to require advanced technical skills and skills in science, technology, engineering, and math. Many native-born American students don't have those skills, and it's not clear that large numbers are going to have them in the future. So we may face a shortage of those individuals, and the transition problem is going to be those workers without those skills who may not be needed in the digital economy. Are they going to be able to get retrained for those skills, for the new jobs that are going to be created?
All right, those are good questions. One of the things that struck me is the people that are making most of the decisions behind this. And so in many cases, you see the higher level executives in corporations, not necessarily invested in creating the corporation. I'm not talking about Henry Ford. I'm talking about some accountant that moved up to a CEO position and has made a lot of hay, basically leading a major corporation. And something that I've always thought is interesting is, from a perspective of artificial intelligence and from time saving and from decision making, it seems like that actually the most replaceable people in a corporation many times would be the CEOs. So why is it that their jobs are not being automated?
It's probably going to be hard to automate the very highest level jobs, just because those jobs are problem solving jobs. They require a lot of flexibility and creativity, and machines have not advanced to the point where they are going to be able to do those jobs. Certainly the blue collar jobs are going to be affected. We're already seeing a lot of automation take those jobs, but the big surprise is going to be that white collar jobs also are getting replaced. So, for example, accountants have to worry about advanced computers that can perform advanced financial calculations. Those are exactly the types of things that accountants do. Many of the mid-level managers are at risk because organizations are getting flatter, and so those mid-level people who used to be supervisors or administrators, some of those jobs have been automated. They're being replaced by software where the people at the bottom of the organization can communicate directly with the people at the top of the organization and vice versa. And so we don't need all those complicated bureaucratic layers in between. So organizations are certainly changing, the business models are changing, and when you combine that with the technology, we're going to live in a very different world.
So the resistance to this, the inertia, as it were, mostly is going to be by displaced workers. And if that's true and we start to propagate this upward to where it's taking people that would be considered solidly in the upper middle class out of the picture, what will be the political feedback to, let's say, put some sort of a, as we've already discussed, some sort of program in place to make sure that people still have earning power or at least purchasing power if they don't have anything to do?
That certainly is going to be one of the big challenges, not just how people earn a living, but mobility in general. You know, one of the strengths of America always been that, you know, people who might have started out without very many advantages, if they worked hard and got a good education, they could end up doing very well. People are worried today as to whether that still is going to be the case. And certainly in the 24 presidential election, we saw a lot of economic anxiety that now President Trump was able to exploit very effectively. And the question today is whether as technology innovation accelerates and the economic impact becomes more apparent, is there going to be a backlash against technology? Are there going to be displaced workers who are angry that they're not sharing in the benefits? When you look at the United States, there's a geographic problem in the sense that a lot of the economic productivity is concentrated on the two coasts as well as in major metropolitan areas in between. But there are large parts of America that don't have technology, that don't have very many jobs, and the people there are anxious and angry about their own economic futures. And so the political aspect of this and the policy aspect are really going to be the most challenging parts of it, like how our system is going to be able to function if there are large elements of the population that are not sharing in the general prosperity, and how they're going to respond, what type of political turmoil the country will be put through based on the difference between people who are sharing in the prosperity versus those who are not.
So one of the things that those are great points. One of the things that I've thought about, and I know a lot of people have, is it comes down to something like, it's very simply stated when you think about self-driving cars. I like to drive. So in other words, a self-driving car in many cases is just a bus, or it's robbing me of my own ability to drive. So in other words, if I'm going down California 1, I want to drive myself. I don't want a self-driving car. And so you guys must work with sociologists on this whole point about whether people have self-worth tied to what it is they do, because it's not just an economic question, it's a human question at some level. So are you guys working with people in those kinds of areas to try to think about how people will respond to a more passive and less active future?
We are looking at those things, and it's interesting, you know, a lot of people actually define both their personal and professional identities today through their jobs. And this is something that actually might change in a positive direction in the future. If there's more productivity and people have more leisure time, people are going to have time to pursue hobbies, interests, art, music, sports, you know, whatever it is that engages them, and that could be quite beneficial. But at the same time, we're also seeing, you mentioned the example of self-driving cars, and obviously not everybody's going to be thrilled with them, but the elderly are going to like this. The disabled are going to benefit clearly from this. And there are a lot of young people today, especially those living in cities, who don't want to own cars anymore. So they're using car sharing services like Uber and Lyft. And those services are already experimenting with autonomous vehicles. And so that may be a way that those self-driving cars come into the marketplace. It's not necessarily people individually have to buy them, but the car sharing services will. Truck driving may become more automated. So those are the parts of the transportation system that may move first in this area.
But is it a slippery slope that some people might see? Because if you start to get both self-driving and human driving cars on the road. People are already worried about the liability issue and who owns the liability if it's a self-driving car. Does the manufacturer own the liability? And if that's true and you can demonstrate that self-driving cars are safer, then sooner or later there's going to be legislation, maybe not now, but 25 years from now, in which case driving your own car means you have to go to a track, which means that only the rich will be able to drive their own car. Is that a future that could happen?
I don't think we're going to end up in that type of a system, but I think the transition period when you're going to have human-driven cars and computer-driven cars on the road at the same time, that is a complex scenario, and you're exactly right to point out there are liability issues. The best argument in favor of autonomous vehicles is going to be their safety record.
Oh, yes,
because
absolutely.
When you look at America today, they're 44,000 people who die in highway accidents every year. And when you look at them, a large percentage of them involve alcohol. We don't have to worry about that with autonomous vehicles. Distracted drivers, people texting while they're driving, people doing all sorts of things. Autonomous vehicles don't get drunk. They don't get distracted. They are going to be more accurate. It doesn't mean there won't be accidents. There will be accidents due to software breakdowns or hardware failures, but there aren't going to be, like if we instantly had everybody in autonomous vehicles on the road, there would not be 44,000 Americans dying every year.
That's true. I mean, I know about the safety is pretty clearly obvious, but I'm going to talk about another point in a minute. But first I want to ask, so have you guys been thinking about the long scale implications of robotics and artificial intelligence, because some people would postulate that there's going to be a future where the robots will build themselves, where the robots will fix themselves and build themselves. And then, of course, they're worried, and I'm sure you guys must joke around about Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, and they worry about that sort of thing. Could such a thing come to effect? Not some sort of apocalyptic zombie sort of thing, but instead a thing where robots can make decisions without the influence of humans and, in fact, make decisions contrary to what a human might decide in a similar circumstance?
Well, robots certainly are already making decisions, and they have become pretty sophisticated in their ability to handle advanced functions. But on the key thing of whether they're going to take over and whether at some point they will become self-reproducing and they won't need us and they will basically take over from humans.
I know it sounds crazy.
It does sound crazy. I am dubious of that scenario. I'm not really worried about that.
Sure.
I mean, maybe 500 years from now, people should worry about that. But they haven't gotten to that, to anywhere close to that in terms of the kind of technology we have now, or even the technology that we're likely to have in the next 25 to 50 years.
But the ironic thing is surgeons could find themselves out of a job within 100 years easily. Don't you think that's true?
There certainly are going to be major changes in healthcare because, for example, it's possible now to do what's called remote surgery, where the surgeon doesn't have to be in the operating room. That surgeon could operate tools through a television screen,
right,
and manual operations and be hundreds of miles away. So that certainly is going to have a big impact. People who read x-rays and who read CAT scans, they don't necessarily have to be in Kansas City. They could be in India. So I think there will be tremendous consequences for healthcare out of some of these new developments.
Sure. Well, you know, with artificial intelligence and let's say image processing, it is clear to me, certainly from my own background, that within 50 years, computers will be able to read CAT scans better than a human could read them. I think that's obviously going to happen. Whether they're allowed to do that or not without a human checking it off, I don't know the answer to that. And so that takes us into the next part. We discussed this already a little bit. The future, the technology is going to continue to change. And so it's the inertia associated with the political will. Is that the main driving force for what's going to happen over the next 20 years?
I think the question is how the general public responds and then how the politicians respond based on a possible backlash. And the backlash can be against the technology. It can be against the inequality that is associated with the technology, or it could be a backlash against job losses generated by technology. So it could happen in a lot of different ways, and it could affect the way our elections take place and the kinds of leaders who we elect. So I think the big variable to watch over the next few decades is the political response and the policy response, because that could well determine whether we end up in utopia or dystopia.
Well, that's a fact. Let me ask you this then. So you've been around D.C. and you know this kind of thing. Would you say that you've seen nuanced reasoned discussion by politicians in general when it comes to these sorts of issues?
No. And that's one thing that concerns me a lot, because all of these topics are very sensitive, because you're talking about the nature of jobs, people's personal identities, their economic livelihood, the way society as a whole functions. And if we had a smooth functioning political system that was capable of dealing with these types of issues with great skill, I would feel a lot better. But of course, that's not the political system we have today. It's a very polarized system. People have their own facts, people arguing a lot, there's a lot of divisiveness. And so, you know, when you look back 100 years ago and the transition from an agrarian to an industrial economy, our political system, it took a while, and it took place over a few decades, but eventually there were new programs put in place, we retrained workers, and people adjusted to that new industrial order. Today, we're undergoing a similar transformation from the industrial world to a digital world, but it's not clear that our political system is going to be able to handle all of the resulting economic, social, and political tensions that come from that. And if the political system doesn't devise policies that help people through this adjustment, that retrains workers, that alters the nature of education so that people are better prepared for the future, that could end up in a much more negative scenario than needs to be the case.
Let's talk about alter the future of education. So being a faculty member in physics for the last almost 30 years, that's near and dear to my heart. You're not supposed to pick winners and losers, but being within the university system, it is very clear that STEM, although occasionally a politician will come out at great expense sometimes to their own reputation and say very positive things about STEM fields and very negative things conversely about, oh, I don't know, art history, unfortunately, perhaps. Is it possible, but yet I see that there are not very many people, for example, going into physics or computer science relative to other nations. So most of my students get good jobs, and yet it is like pulling teeth to get people to major in physics. Does the government have to take a more active role, not to force people, but to, let's say, incentivize retraining? Let's put it that way.
We certainly need to encourage students to be going into all of these STEM fields, the sciences, computer science, technology, engineering, and math. I mean, those are the types of people who we will need in the digital economy. And you're exactly right. We are not producing enough of those individuals right now. So that certainly is a big problem. I think one thing that could help is a lot of people view all these fields that we're going to need as purely science fields, but we also are going to need design people. Like, you know, one of the reasons people like Apple products is they are just so well designed, they're easy to use, they're very functional. And so that combination of arts and design with the science field is a good combination. We're going to need people who can translate science to non-scientists. So there, people shouldn't think that we're only going to need a scientist. Like, the humanities still are going to play a role, people with great design skills, and maybe even artists could do well in the coming world.
Absolutely. And I would be certainly in favor of that completely, because people are going to make the argument, which I think is the correct one, that a future that's economically sound but devoid of beauty and art isn't much of a future. So do you see basically right now for the foreseeable future, it's going to be laissez-faire essentially. The companies are going to develop things as fast as they can, except let's say in cloning and stem cells and a couple of other areas, and then the government will play catch up. Is that what's going to happen?
That has pretty much been the situation over the last 30 years and is likely to be the situation going forward. Companies have the freedom to innovate pretty much as much as they want, except for, as you mentioned, fields like cloning and genetic modifications. the government is always playing a catch-up, and so that's always very difficult on its part. And so given the likelihood that technology innovation is going to continue to accelerate, that's the reason why I think we have to focus on the policy response and the social response for society as a whole. We have to assume that there are going to be consequences for the workforce, that some people are going to be left behind, and we have to figure out how to deal with that in order to avoid a very negative future.
Well, I agree with everything you've just said. Dr. West, thank you so much for stopping by and speaking with me.
Thank you, David. It's nice talking with you.
And this is Dave Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.